are tuned in to People's Tribune Radio. I'm Kenny Shook. On this edition of PTR, we hear from General Baker about the development of a United States empire.
We're being marginalized in the position of supporting the question of empire on the basis of a fight against terror. This has become the ideological cover for all these attacks at home. I mean, no matter what you do, whatever you raise, people want to go back to 9/11 like ain't nothing happened since then. One of the difficulties is that the propaganda networks in this country and all the propagandists on the right that support this question of empire just have mastery of the airways. You know, our little voice is putrid and small. It also shows how gullible the American people are. To just buy up this propaganda and nonsense. And I think we run a real danger when, under empire, when there's no principle at all involved in things, you're just forced to believe whatever's said by the State Department, going about your way.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publishes the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo. Ordering and contact information will be provided at the end of the show. General Baker is a member of the Detroit Local 600 and works for the Roots Steel Company, which is a steel provider for Ford. Baker was interviewed by PTR correspondent David Apsey with regards to the development of a U.S. empire.
Clearly, when we understand this question of empire as being one nation dominant over an entire world, as opposed to a period of globalization that's a coalition of nations running the world, and since we are moving in a position of the United States outright dominance and deciding to do what it wants to do, irregardless of anybody else's opinion, and taking up the question of going it alone and running the risk. Read an interesting article in the past June's edition of The Economist magazine almost a year ago. And the title of that article was Were You Present at the Creation? And they talk about periods in history in which the whole world is realigned and reestablished. For instance, in this case, they were talking about President Truman at the end of World War II. And he had the opportunity to recreate this new world. Well, we currently in another period like that today, where Bush is pushing ahead with this question of empire to reorganize this world on the basis of U.S. dominance at the expense of everything. Some of the characteristic features of this period is so absurd. Everything is contradictory. I mean, everything that comes out of their mouths is a lie. But they contradict themselves and just keep right on stepping because nobody holds them in check. One of the most characteristic features of this period for me has been seeing how it's such a cover for the devastation we're faced with in the economy. At the shop I'm working in, I told you it's been a steel mill since the 20s. We've faced with the first layoffs we've had in the last 15 years. They're cutting out 200 people, throwing them into the streets, simply because steel ain't selling, because the domestic market is depressed. And that's just one example of all the massive layoffs you want to talk about that's taking place. And at the same time, you know, pushing this patriotism and this question of warmongering and control of the earth and the world on the one hand, and that being a satisfactory solution to the loss of all the jobs and things on the other hand.
Baker relates some of the attacks on civil liberties found today to the state harassment displayed in the 60s. He also relates the historical relationship of anti-communism and anti-terrorism.
What presses me the most about it is this this question of development of the rise of fascism at home while we have empire across the globe. This fascism at home really is characterized by the political expression of the objective concentration of wealth and the spread of poverty. So if we see fascism in that light, we can see all of the things that are developing here at home that are frightening. I am particularly perturbed about a couple of things, this whole question of national security and what it means. I have received in the last 5 months letters and notifications from every credit union or bank that I work with, every hospital that I take the children to or that I use. And they have a thing called a review of a privatization policy. And what they, and even though it's a lot of rhetoric, and when you look at it and the changes that are taking place, the only new addition is the fact that If somebody from the National Security Office asks them for your bank records or asks them for your health report, they will get it immediately. And they'll get it faster than you will. I have trouble sometimes getting my own medical report released from the hospitals. And they have these forms, so they got you signing consents saying that you have been handed this policy, and you can fill it out if you want to, saying you read it and understood it, just to cover their own butts. But that's a tragic set of circumstances. I mean, you could be harassed from so many different angles. And the harassment is broad and huge. I mean, I come out of the struggles in the 60s, in which I already knew some of this was possible, but it was kind of hidden. But I had got files from the Internal Revenue Service that showed every bank account I ever had, every check I ever signed. I had all kind of harassment, you know, by the Detroit Police Department and Red Squad files in the 60s and 70s. So I knew a lot of this existed, so it wasn't a surprise to me. I was one of the ones that was arrested during the Detroit Rebellion and sent to Ione State Penitentiary for 15 days for violation of curfew. So I realized the oppressive nature of the state in certain periods of time, and obviously that was before they had a Patriotic Act. And if they could do that without the Patriotic Act, Lord knows what we confronted with today. A couple other points on that. I think this recent release of the McCarthy files is an absurd play on history and a play on the American people. They released the McCarthy files done in 1954, now in almost 2004. Obviously, the logic of this thing is to try to say, all we did was not right. We trampled on people's freedoms. And in essence, what they're trying to say is we're not doing this no more, which ain't true. I mean, they're doing it on a higher level and with different excuses. I mean, the McCarthy period was one that was narrowed down to communism. And we done learned already today that this question of terror is just as accommodating as the anti-communist threat was. I mean, they can change the nature of a threat just that fast. We went from anti-communism now to anti-threat, anti-terror. And anti-terror, matter of fact, is a much more broader scheme than anti-communism. You can't really tie this anti-terror thing down. So I think that's really an absurd plank that we confronted with. The McCarthy tapes was released, and we're supposed to now feel free. And I question this because this question of a new American empire that we're confronted with and its devastation on the working class here at home is really oppressive. It's devastating, and it's very far-reaching.
Baker uses an example of state Democrat legislators fleeing Texas en masse in order to avoid arrest by Texas Rangers. The governor used the National Office of the Department of Homeland Security to follow the legislators across the border into Oklahoma. Baker relates this to features of the development of empire within the United States.
The one other example, I think, just to show you how bad it is. This is a struggle in upheaval. You know, obviously the level of the economy and the social struggle here at home is getting to the point where it's creating upheaval. One of the biggest fronts, I thought, when one of the biggest spontaneous movements was the work of the Texas state legislature. These guys, all the Democrats, slipped out of the legislature and decided to go AWOL, so they didn't have a quorum and therefore couldn't take care of business. They slipped across the border to Oklahoma because the governor assigned the Texas Rangers to locate them and bring them back. So they eased across the Oklahoma border to a hotel room and stayed until the session was over. So therefore, the redistricting that was going to take place under the Republican administration didn't take place this year. But the aftermath of that is that this new Office of National Security was used to track them. Now, here's the Office of National Security, supposed to be built up to fight terror. And they're in the process of tracking and following their own legislators out of the state of Texas. Matter of fact, they tracked them to Oklahoma, tracking one of the planes of the representatives that flew across the border to Oklahoma for a state, and that's created upheaval. But that just shows you, I think, the level of the dangers of this rise of fascism and this new American empire and its fascist danger here at home. So I think it's really important that we really key in and address ourselves to this new set of circumstances, because the new set of circumstances are bringing on It's all kind of lies for the rationale. And one other accommodating thing too is the consistent and constant attacks on the UN. It was already under attack, and even now, they got whole sections of the U.S. Congress that's attacking it for its human rights policy and trying to say it's absurd. So it's as we move towards empire, it's forced to attack those old bodies that were coalitions on an international level that allowed it to have cover. But I think those are the most important, I think, features of this current period of empire, and kind of what it means here at home. And these are just opening features. We can look forward to more and more of this kind of harassment and attacks, you know, on the rights of American workers. At the same time, the struggle of American workers has to escalate, which the new American is so devastated based on the economy.
This is People's Tribune Radio. You are listening to an interview of General Baker, who is discussing the development of U.S. empire. Next, Baker discusses the marginalization of the UN and NATO through the increase of aggression across the world, which is spearheaded by the United States.
We're being marginalized in the position of supporting the question of empire on the basis of a fight against terror. I think it's become the ideological cover for all these attacks at home. I mean, no matter what you do, whatever you raise, people want to go back to 9/11 like ain't nothing happened since then. I think that one of the difficulties is that the propaganda networks in this country and all the propagandists on the right that support this question of empire just have a mastery of the airwaves. You know, our little voice is putrid and small. And it also shows how gullible the American people are to just buy up this propaganda and nonsense. And I think we run a real danger when under empire, when there's no principle at all involved in things. You're just forced to believe whatever state said by the State Department and go on about your way. One of the things even the old Economist article pointed out was about how contradictory everything is. They talk about U.S. and its policy, and it says that they have defined their war as a good against evil, of civilization against terror. But when they butted their heads against the bloodstained brick wall that is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they have spoken about a regime of change in Iraq, but have done little about it. They have said they favor democracy, but then hesitated to condemn an attempted coup in April on Venezuela. So they just say what they want to say, and that just becomes policy. And we've been marginalized on the basis of no truth at all, no truth at all. I mean, the biggest scandal and hassle is this question of weapons of mass destruction, and they never been found. You know, now they're bringing out articles saying the CIA lied about spotting them, but they still haven't come up with them, even under occupation. You know, but at the same time, the whole rationale for toppling the regime is not there, but the regime has been toppled. Just the same. So I think those are the real dangers. We're really being marginalized on the basis of just strict propaganda in defense of their ability to establish here. This is a big empire. And go it alone, irregardless of who. And even those that find themselves temporary allies are going to be in difficulty, in trouble. Britain, Spain, Australia. Even under those coalitions, you know, there's no trust at all in there. But I really wanted to point out, I think, that this strive towards new American empire, its devastation here at home is basically a slap on our civil liberties, you know, and a real restriction on the American working class and denying its rights. At the same time, it's being forced to struggle and fight for the basic economic rights that we are losing based on the globalization and the economic crisis that we're confronted with.
Baker goes on to relate U.S. empire with the struggle of labor unions and workers.
We're just beginning to embark upon what all this means for labor, particularly this year. This is a big bargaining year. A lot of significant contracts will be argued and bargained on this year, and they'll be argued and bargained under the worst conditions that labor has ever had to bargain and labor under. As you know, and it doesn't hit the news all that time, the struggle around the electronic method of production goes on and on as we sit here. It has never stopped, and even though we don't have a chance to talk about it and address it every day more and more robots are being introduced into the job, more and more new technical processes are being introduced to the job, making it less and less available for people to be able to work, and much more difficult for people to able to develop a method to live. So first of all, saying that, I want to say that in the current contracts, the squeeze of international markets, you know, Detroit's a big auto town. And oftentimes we measure and look at development based on that. Well, a whole lot of things have happened. We have such an influx of foreign capital into the, what used to be the big three market that is, it's not figured the same as it used to be. Matter of fact, it's forced Automotive News and some of these places to refer to all this influx that's pretty much taking place in the South. They renamed Alabama Autobama because they got so many new auto plants that went there. Every one of them are foreign capital, Korean, German, Japanese, and they're competing on a high level. With the SUV market, the traditional pickup market that used to be, you know, the bottom line of the big three holding on to the pickup trucks, you know, and that's gone too. So we're confronted with the increased influx of competition in the auto sector. Even though these plants are built onshore, they're pretty much mainly non-union. And the foreign capital that came in had learned a lot in terms of how to try to organize these shops by hiring workers all over the state. They really couldn't communicate with each other. And so it'll be a long while before there's a organizational drive to bring some victory in those shops. And even the organizational drive doesn't bring you that much, except limits the competition between U.S. and foreign cars. I want to say that because I think that going into a contract, set of contract negotiations, with these kind of economic times facing you, has always been difficult for labor. But with the patriotism tied to it, and with the attacks on health insurance and health care that's arising at the same time, makes it almost ominous that you're coming out of there with some kind of beaten down, watered down contract. And one of those things happened for the most part is that these labor unions are forced to turn more inward. They're forced to try to fight for everything they can for their own little narrow membership, as opposed to fighting for the broad aspects of the class. And therefore, they institute all kind of two-tier wage systems, new people coming in to be hired at half the rate the old people were, all kind of methods of attack on the working class instead of seeing the broader picture, you know, in a real class fight. And nothing has been done about CEO and corporate leaders' pay and income. I mean, they're still making billions of dollars. I mean, it's absurd while they're throwing workers in the street on the other end and therefore exacerbating this contradiction between poverty and wealth, which is the basis of the developing fascism in this country. So I think in that sense, we have a real difficult period of time in front of us. Labor has to find a way to broaden its flank, to fight for all of those that would have ability to try to work for a living and not narrow itself down to its narrow little membership, which now in the industrial sector is probably about 9% of the American working class that's unionized in the industrial sector. So it's so bad, I mean, just tying yourself to that narrow section obviously can't bring you any kind of relief at a period of time when we should have the broadest program we can, especially a program that's united around the necessities of the poor section of society, which is the only way out. So I think these are the kind of things we can look forward in this bargaining round that we're confronted with that is culminating now. I think the big GE contract is up now. They had GE workers hit the streets en masse as the start of their negotiations, which means there's a certain level of labor activism beginning at the same time. It's a real difficult time to bargain.
This is PTR. The following interview is with General Baker surrounding the question of empire. Baker begins to address the political maneuvering and social responses to the conditions facing workers employed and unemployed.
Part of this is really the social response to the developing crisis. And this social response is beginning to develop certain levels of upheavals. There's a lot of political maneuvering taking place. Here in Detroit, for instance, we just had a local upstart who's kind of like a friend that won a city council seat, where all the political pundits said that 2 days before that the old hack was going to win by a landslide. And she won an open council seat that a council person that died last fall had to fill. So there's a lot of changes. We recently had the largest hip-hop conference in Detroit, where 15,000 people showed up down at Cobo Hall, and they referred to the local mayor as a hip-hop mayor, but I think one of the things one of the pundits said was Simmons, and he was talking about the emergence of the hip-hop movement. He talked about how it's one of the most important movements that's developed a unity between the races in the last 30 years. He said, we now have the Trailer Park United with the Project under the guise of hip-hop. He also went on to point it out that these forces, that a lot of them are more popular, obviously, than the President and Secretary of State on an international level. And that a lot of the protests that took place around the war and all were these young people. And soon they'll be the voters on a global level and therefore exercise a different kind of influence on the political regimes across the globe. So I thought those were important revelations. But clearly, labor needs an agenda. Labor needs to take into account all these objective upheavals that's taking place. But we're fortunate enough in this country at this point to have the development of a labor party that developed independent of the other parties that developed spontaneously within the 80s and 90s, and therefore exist out there with a class program based and set up in a class, all those that find themselves dispossessed, with a program that touches upon our education, our collective bargaining, our health care, you know, our poverty issues. It touches on them all, and therefore we have a rallying center to rally around. And we're fortunate enough that it exists, so we don't have to take up the task of trying to build that. So that's an important lever. How do we break the rest of the trade union section and the rest of the spontaneous fighters in the neighborhoods to get to this labor party is really the critical question, which becomes really an educational task, because unless a class develops a sense of a class in terms of working and struggling together, they see that their struggles are not issue-orientated, but they find many allies as they step out. Only when we overcome that difficulty will we be able to bring the growth of people into the labor party that we see as being essential in this period of time of developing class unity.
Currently, Baker is discussing the importance of the labor party, acting as a political organization with the potential to unite people across class lines.
It's clear that the labor party is not going to be able to negotiate contracts. It will have to concentrate itself on the political motions that labor finds in common. And oftentimes we're kind of conditioned in this country to not seeing parties active like they should be. We just see them as being election machines. I mean, we develop a labor party where we see it calling demonstrations and protests. It was significant that the labor party came out with a statement against the war, you know, and even though it wasn't out there real early, it was out there with a statement about that, and we have to see labor organize itself in a real political motion, and not just limited to the economic fights. I'm not sure how much of that development will take place in the current contract. Of course, everything is considered contract negotiations taking place just here, but everything is so volatile. It would be bad for us not to keep our eyes open and anticipation of upheavals that we haven't seen yet. Things are possible. I mentioned earlier, who would have thought that the Democratic state legislature in Texas would leave en masse and go across the border? I mean, that would be, people wouldn't believe you if you told them that 6 months ago, but it took place already, it happened. So I think that we have to get ourselves in a position for anticipation of these struggles and not narrow ourselves down on what we anticipate and not narrow ourselves down on what we expect. And I think we have to have a real openness on that. We don't have a lot of guidelines in terms of which way the struggle is going to go. We know that it's going two ways. The fascists are trying to take over, and we're trying to present our position. The fascists are in a much better position than us because they control the media airwaves. But the American people are genuine people. When you can get to them with the proper message, they rally to that too. You know, so I think it's a real important juncture in history that we reach.
The following is an editorial from the People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, titled, Which Way for the Peace Movement? The massive worldwide movement against the war in Iraq brought millions of people into the streets of America's cities. Now that the war seems to have ended, at least a section of the peace movement in the United States seems disoriented and demoralized, unsure where to challenge the energy that was tapped by the war. Here are some things to think about. For one thing, the peace movement has always been more than just peace. It is and has been the focal point for a broad-based discontent about many things that are going wrong in America. For another thing, the war is not over. Let's deal with the second point first. The U.S. government is continuing a low-level war against the people of Iraq, and don't forget Afghanistan, as a part of the ongoing effort to secure U.S. control of the Middle East and Central Asia. And the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan are only the beginning. We will continue to see war after war, whether in the Middle East, Asia, or elsewhere, as the U.S. ruling class tries to realize its dream of world domination. Thus, we must continue to demand peace. Peace means not simply an end to this or that war, but an end to war and the threat of war as an instrument of national policy. And it means the creation and strengthening of international institutions that can guarantee peace. Beyond this, what is really at the root of the peace movement, consciously or unconsciously, is not just opposition to an unjust and immoral war, but a whole set of questions about what kind of society we have and where we are headed. These questions must be brought into the movement, so it can be politicized and made conscious of a broader task. The war against Iraq and its aftermath have laid bare contradictions that cannot be ignored. The rapid collapse of the Iraqi army, weakened by 12 years of military economic warfare, puts the lie to the notion that Iraq was a military threat to anyone. The same can be said of the U.S. government's failure to find any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. The U.S. government's words and actions have made clear that the U.S. ruling class has its own agenda for Iraq and the Middle East, and that, far from being liberated, the Iraqi people have simply been delivered into an American dictatorship. The American people should demand that the U.S. leave Iraq, and that the rebuilding of the country be turned over to the United Nations. U.S. pronouncements about Iraq also raise other questions that the peace movement should call to the attention of the American people. The U.S. government plans to put school books in the hands of every Iraqi child within a year. Yet, public schools are being closed in this country due to budget cuts. And the U.S. government says it is bringing democracy to Iraq, yet democracy has been all but eliminated here. Finally, we should understand a simple truth about why we could not stop the war to begin with. The American working class, which constitutes the vast majority of the people, does not have political power. If the American people really controlled this country's government and foreign policy, would we have made war on Iraq? Would we be closing schools and turning our country into a police state? Wouldn't we make the government responsible for the well-being of the people? Wouldn't we guarantee healthcare, education, housing, food, and the right to be free from arbitrary arrest and imprisonment? It is more clear than ever that the working class needs its own political party. The people are engaged in a struggle for political power. We need our own party to help us wage the struggle. We need to see that we're not just confronting bad politicians, but a bad system. If the peace movement can begin to see that it is part of a much larger struggle, then its vast energies can be turned toward creating the mass consciousness and the political means necessary to accomplish what really needs to be done, winning real political power for the American people. That is it for this edition of People's Tribune Radio. PTR is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. The League advocates for a cooperative society where the same technologies that are being used to displace millions of workers around the world are used for the benefit of humanity as a whole. If you would like to contact the League about our print, media, or speakers bureau, you may do so by calling 1-800-691-6888. That's 1-800-691-6888. Or visit us on the internet at www.lrna.org. I'm Kenny Shook, and on behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we hope you join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.